The most severe episode happened in 2015 when out of the blue, I just filed for divorce because this is what happens to a lot of people with bipolar disorder when they're in a manic phase. They think that the cause of their problems, it's everybody else's fault.
Welcome to the Brown Girl Podcast. This show was created to elevate the voices and perspectives of dual identity South Asians around the world. Here we have conversations on topics and issues that impact our community, as well as share the stories of personal successes and the struggles that often go unsaid. My name is Julie George, and I'm your host.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode. Thank you so much for joining today's conversation. Today, we are talking about mental health and the impacts on family and marriage. So we have with us Shelly Sood and Nikhil Torsikar. They are married. Nikhil went almost 20 years of having an undiagnosed mental health disorder. And so today we learn about how that impacted their lives, their careers, how it almost ended their marriage. In fact, they had already initiated the divorce proceedings before being able to turn things around and for Nikhil to get the help that he needed. This episode was recorded back in October. Shelly and Nikhil do a lot. They are involved in a lot of different things, including being the host of a podcast that has been rebranded since the recording of this episode to be called Untether Your Life. So if you want to get in touch with them, please reference the show notes, which has the most up-to-date information on their branding and handles and things like that. Here's our conversation. Hey, Shelly and Nikhil, thank you so much for joining me today. This is the first time I'm having more than one guest on the same podcast, so I'm excited that the both of you are here. Before we start, I wanted to just read a quick bio on the both of you. I actually took this from some of the excerpts that you had sent me from the intake form. Shelly Sood is an author, speaker, mother of three, wife, and entrepreneur. Her husband of 20 years, Nikhil, had suffered from undiagnosed bipolar disorder for 2 decades, leading to massive devastation emotionally, mentally, and financially. After helping to save his life and their marriage, Shelly launched a healthcare company called GeoStar Chicago. Nikhil seemed to have it all. He'd attended the top schools, had a thriving career at the world's top corporations, and a loving wife and 3 kids. One day, it all came crashing down. He lost his executive-level position, found himself in a bitter divorce, and had nowhere to live. Further analysis revealed that Nikhil had suffered from undiagnosed bipolar disorder, going from staggering highs and incapacitating lows for 20 years. After becoming suicidal and ultimately getting diagnosed at the age of 40, he began a journey of introspection and healing and is now a devoted husband, dedicated parent, and thriving professional. He runs the Untether Your Life podcast, serves as director of marketing for GeoStar Chicago, and is a tireless mental health advocate. So I know you guys have a book that's in the works and you're working with producers on filming a memoir as well. So we'll definitely chat more about that later. But before we delve into your story, I know we were just chatting about this right before, but we actually are from pretty close neighboring towns in the suburbs of Chicago. So I grew up in Des Plaines. You guys are just around the corner. It's such a small world, but I'm curious, how did the both of you guys meet?
So it was actually at a ping pong tournament, if you can believe it. We're actually from the same town in Toledo, Ohio. It's one of those things where I've spent more of my life in Chicago than anywhere else. So I kind of consider this my hometown, but Toledo is where we grew up. We were in the same community, very tight knit. And people hear that we met at 9 and they're, oh, childhood sweethearts. But that wasn't quite the story because you know how Indian communities are very tight knit. You know, we call each other parents, uncles, and aunties. But our parents were friends. We started going on vacations. And then Shelly moved to Chicago in late 90s to study at DePaul. And then we started dating after that. And I guess, yeah, the rest is history. So we got married in 2001. So
basically, you met at 9 and then reconnected decades later.
Yeah, very exactly. Cool.
So, you know, the topic of today's discussion is about the undiagnosed bipolar disorder that you had, the impact on the family and the marriage, and ultimately how the both of you were able to come out on the other side. And so with bipolar disorder, we actually did an episode several months ago about bipolar disorder with a guest, Sabrina Singh, and I was able to learn quite a bit from her. And I think the biggest takeaway for me was that, like, bipolar disorder is so much more than how the media often minimizes it as just being moody. And so a quick recap, bipolar disorder, as I understand it, is that you're oscillating between these lows, like debilitating lows, which would be like severe depression, and then these euphoric highs, which is called mania. And so sometimes these episodes can last days, it can last weeks, sometimes months, even longer. It can really vary person to person. And suicidal ideation is very common. And just overall, it's something that can be really, really crippling in every which way if it's not able to be managed appropriately. I don't know if there's anything else that you want to add in there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a pretty good summation. And two things I would add to that is, one, I don't know what the list is officially, but I do know that it's probably one of the hardest diseases to diagnose. And the reason for that is that I always say, like, I don't know have you seen the movie Limitless with Bradley Cooper?
No.
Okay, so when people ask me to describe bipolar disorder, I always say that's the best description of it, because it's basically like you're sort of puttering along, you're in, you know, funk, you know, you're not getting anything done. And then all of a sudden it's like the light switches. You're very creative and dynamic and, like you said, euphoric. And people in that state, I mean, they think they're on top of the world. They think they can do anything. The last thing they want to do is talk to a shrink who's going to put them on something that's going to, you know, dumb them down. Right.
Right.
So a lot of times they wait until they fall into a deep depression and then they go in for diagnosis. And if a psychiatrist is talking to someone and they're saying, you know, I can't get out of bed and I feel like utter garbage, they're going to diagnose it as depression. So that's why a lot of times it does get misdiagnosed as depression. And that's what happened to me a few times. And then the other thing is, if it does get treated as depression, prescribing an antidepressant without a mood stabilizer can actually, I always say it's like lighting a match on a pile of logs that's dunked in gasoline. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So it can make your bipolar symptoms even worse if you're being treated with an antidepressant.
Exactly. And the only time a patient goes is when they're depressed. So typically they're giving the doctor half the picture of really what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So Nikhil, you went 20 years of having undiagnosed bipolar disorder. I'd love for both of you to just share what life was like individually during that time. And maybe Nikhil, we can start with you, but tell us what life was like during those years. Like, how would you describe yourself as a person? What were you experiencing during those years? And how did that manifest in the way you were interacting with the world around you?
Yeah, sure. What kind of dog do you have, by the way?
He's an Australian Labradoodle. I had to kick him out.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Sounds pretty big. Yeah. No, we have a King Charles Cavalier Spaniel. He behaves pretty well for these things, but knock on wood.
Yeah.
So I would say that it was basically, like, in my experience, the depressive phase was always a lot longer than the manic phase. It started in college where, you know, I was pre-med and I was taking a very rigorous course load and burnt out, you know, because I tried to take organic chemistry in one summer. And then I was just in a funk. You know, I just felt like I couldn't do right. And I just didn't want to go to class and anything. And then what happened was, it was like one day it was like a light switch went off. And I just felt very creative, able to work with very little sleep, you know, just on top of the world. And then when I crashed, it was, you know, sort of like cycle repeating itself, which is just basically depression continuously. I would say that what was interesting was I always talk about two things. One is cultural, and then the other thing is professional. Because culturally, as you know, being of South Asian descent, there's almost this glorification of having that made of steel kind of constitution, you know, where you're able to work night and day, you're able to, you know, socialize, you're able to do 10 activities and pull it off, you know, just effortlessly. And so that was sort of like the work ethic that I aspired to. And that was how my mom sort of carried herself. And she, it's interesting, I always, you know, bring this up, is that there's definitely a genetic component to this, because she would always have all these characteristics of someone with bipolar disorder, you know, which is requiring little sleep, irritability, a lot of creativity, but, you know, it could be very stressful to be around. But that was sort of like the paragon, you know, where it was like, you know, she's a doctor, she's dynamic, she's sort of the life of the party. And that was sort of like the gold standard that I tried to live up to. And ultimately, I found that that was just not a sustainable way of doing things, because as I would find is just it would always lead to the crash. And then the most severe episode happened in 2015 when out of the blue, I just filed for divorce, because this is what happens to a lot of people with bipolar disorder when they're in a manic phase. They think that the cause of their problems, it's everybody else's fault. It's not something they need to work on with a therapist. So let's just cut out that annoying friend or that spouse or whatever, cut out the family. And, you know, that's basically what it took for me to go and seek treatment, was to basically hit rock bottom. You know, Shelly was the one who really, it's almost like, I sometimes wonder, I'm like, what was in it for her? Because it was like, we were on the verge of divorce, but she was the one who convinced me to go get treatment.
Right. And Shelly, what was life like for you during that time, you know, being his partner and basically being on the sidelines?
Well, you know, for so many years, I didn't know what was going on, because he was traveling. So he was in the consulting lifestyle, traveling 4 to 5 days a week. So I really wouldn't see sort of the manic side of the disease. Only at times I would see him being very depressed. And naturally, I turned to my father-in-law, his father, who was a psychiatrist too, for any help or support and a clinical understanding of what was happening to him. So, you know, I relied on him solely and just did not take matters into my own hands and kind of just went along with the flow. I was the, you know, the typical South Asian wife, devoted to her husband, wanted to build relationships with her in-laws and try to please everyone. I was a pleaser. And at the same time, we were trying to raise 3 children. So I had my hands full and, you know, didn't really focus on his health issues. When he was depressed, I did the usual, well, get right back up again, you know, or when he lost his job, you can do it, you know. And one of the things that I was holding on to is he has a very high IQ. And, you know, so I would say to him, well, you have high IQ, you know, top 5% in or 2% in the country, in the world. And there's no reason you can't do this. You have the smarts, you have the intelligence, you have the brains. But there was really no grasp or understanding of emotional intelligence, how important that is in the workplace. And, you know, the fact that we had an undiagnosed bipolar disorder going on. So, you know, fast forward 15 years later, I'm thinking we're in a pretty happy marriage. Of course, we had our ups and downs like the typical married couple. But we had beautiful moments when we had our children together, and, you know, we had a lot of good times that I cherish. But in 2015, he suddenly, like you said, filed for divorce, said, I don't love you anymore. And that's when the rug was just pulled out from underneath.
Right. When did you start to have an inkling that there was something more to his mental state that needed to be investigated?
The moment he filed for divorce.
Okay. So before that, you just thought, he's being the way that he is because that's just how he is.
That's just how he is. And that was, it was normalized in my mind. Yeah. Because you get so used to something that you normalize it. That's life. That's marriage. That's the way it is.
Right. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is I sort of had the insight early on because I had experienced those highs and lows. And I actually did come to her because I had read an article. It was called The Hypomanic American, where it was in the Boston Globe. They talk about bipolar 2, which is a different, I have bipolar 1, but they talk about basically Americans who are, they have, you know, flights of creative energy and they're very dynamic, enthusiastic, creative, and then they'll go through depression. And it was like, it was sometimes you see something and you feel like it describes you to a T. But I think Shelly, because, you know, even it's interesting, even though being like me being the son of a psychiatrist and being fairly progressive, I'd say Shelly's, to be honest, I mean, her perspective on mental health was a little bit outdated. So I think she didn't really want to delve into that thought. She didn't want to sort of explore the possibility that there, you know, that this might be bipolar disorder.
It was too much for me to absorb that. And a lot of it, as we know, is the mental health stigma culturally. You know, it was really also about sort of my ego, to be honest.
Right. And so when you would try to get help from his dad, who is a psychiatrist, what would be his response?
It was very unclear. I mean, he thought maybe he had some depression here and there, but nobody really owned up to the fact that it potentially was bipolar disorder. And during this whole drop that started in 2015, he really didn't have a very consistent diagnosis either. There was very little clinical detachment to really be able to treat him properly.
Mm-hmm. And then as far as the diagnosis, so we just talked about how Nikhil was getting misdiagnosed with depression. How did you get them to realize that they were wrong all those years?
When I had my epiphany and he had filed for divorce, I knew it was bipolar disorder. So the first person, again, when I turned to was his father. And I said, look, you know, I didn't say it was bipolar disorder because I didn't want to go in there and claim I was a doctor and that I could diagnose him. However, I did tell him, okay, this is what I've witnessed, this kind of behavior, which describes somebody who was manic versus somebody who was depressed. So I kind of put the pieces together for him and presented it to him. But by then, Nikhil had kind of poisoned the well and had already talked about how we had a damaged marriage and he was never happy to begin with. And he just wants out. To most people, you know, logical people, rational people, it's a very common thing. Okay. He just decided he didn't want to be married to me anymore. Or maybe it's a midlife crisis, you know, or maybe he was never even happy ever to begin with. And so it was a really easy story for them to buy.
Right. So were you trying to go around to like, to get second opinions? Like, were you going to different doctors and different psychiatrists? No,
probably 10 different opinions.
Oh. So you were doing a lot of investigation and research up front yourself to like create this case.
Yes. Yes. I needed some support from somebody who had power and control in the situation because I lost complete and total control.
Uh-huh. And then Nikhil, I'm curious what life was like professionally, because when you had this undiagnosed bipolar disorder, you were in a very rigorous MBA program at the University of Chicago. You had very high level positions in the corporate environments. And I would imagine all of that is, that type of work is very demanding in nature. So did you feel like when you had these manic periods, did you feel like that helped you? I don't think help is the right word, but did you feel that the manic episodes of bipolar where your energy was really elevated, you have these racing thoughts and ideas, did you feel that enabled you to, you know, operate in these kinds of high octane, high pressure environments?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting the difference between perception and reality. You know, in the book, we talk about the expression I use is it's like bipolar disorder was like this magic elixir for me. Not bipolar, but mania, because basically, the schedule that I had at the time was I was doing my MBA at University of Chicago, which is obviously a pretty competitive program, pretty rigorous. I was working at an investment research firm, managing a team in India. We just had our second kid and, you know, then commuting from the suburbs. So I couldn't do that today. Definitely not. But yeah, I kind of looked at it as like a badge of honor. And I think, I don't know if this is common for everybody, but with my experience with bipolar disorder, there were a lot of, it was like, it almost had like a cinematic quality to it. So like, there's characters like in Entourage, there's the character, his name's Ari Gold. I don't know if you're familiar with that show, but just really like abrasive and argumentative and getting in everyone's face and like, you know, just kind of like a drill sergeant type of behavior, you know?
Like alpha male.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, exactly. That was sort of like the ethos that I aspired to. And it was not very constructive because, yeah, I mean, I think things got done. But if I were to look at like productivity and efficiency, I mean, I was constantly working. And so I was sort of succumbing to that dark side of the American dream, which is that hustle culture, you know, which is just constantly checking my phone and getting on people's cases about stuff and just not taking care of myself. So, yeah, I mean, I would say I did sort of have this misguided notion that it wasn't an Achilles heel. It was like a secret power, so to speak.
Right. And so prior to the formal diagnosis of bipolar disorder, Nikhil, were you going to therapy and seeing psychologists and things like that pretty consistently?
Yeah. So I've talked about this on other podcasts. And the interesting thing is I kind of had a dim view of mental health for most of my life, just because I was a kid who got into trouble a lot in grade school and high school. And so whenever I had to see a therapist, it was always like I did something wrong. So it's like a conditioned response. I'm like, oh, great. you know, I have to sit here and it's like going to the principal's office almost, you know? And so I started seeing a therapist after, in the book we talk about, you know, I'd had a panic attack and we thought it would be a good idea for me to start seeing someone on a regular basis. And, the problem is it's so important to find a good therapist. And when I say a good therapist, I mean someone who's going to challenge you and not just be your cheerleader. Because yes, I mean, I think it is good when you're in a depressive phase, if you have support around you, if you have people who are like, oh, that's great. You know, you're sort of if I had a nickel for every time I heard, oh, it's the old Nikhil is back again, you know, could probably put another addition on our house because it was just like, yeah, I'd be like, all of a sudden I'd be working all hours of the day and very quote unquote productive and creative. But it was, yeah. And this is the problem is that I had a therapist who was kind of, it was almost like she was an enabler. Because she saw that I was going from being very downtrodden to talking about all these relationships I was building, talking about all these new projects, talking about all these speaking engagements. And so I would say that in some respects, I think therapy did more harm than good because it was the wrong therapist.
So fast forward now to 2015, Nikhil, you basically hit rock bottom. You filed for divorce. And is that what forced you to be like, okay, I'll give this a try, I'll go in and see if maybe Shelly is onto something?
Yeah, it was a whole host of things. I mean, I had lost not just one job, but this was like, I think the fourth in a series within like 5 years, you know, four jobs lost. And I talk about in the book, like all this time you've been looking through the looking glass at reality, where basically everything looks beautiful and colorful. And all of a sudden it's like, the real mirror comes out. You know, I don't know what they call them, fat mirrors or something, like where it's just basically like all the flaws and everything in my reality just sort of came, you know, kind of smacked me in the face. And I think what was really jarring for me was just the fact that Shelly actually revealed to me that my parents had just kind of said, they kind of washed their hands of me, because Shelly was saying to them that, hey, you know, he needs help. He's in a bad place. And my dad, he had actually said to her, oh, no, he's got a plan. He's a Academy Award winning actor. He's a sociopath. He's kind of had you fooled all this time, you know. And so that's kind of like, I always think of like a tower of Jenga, which is basically like that one piece just kind of like crumbled, you know. And so the facade was just sort of broken at that point. So that was a tough moment. And at that point, I was like, whatever I'm doing is just not cutting it. So, you know, I just waved the white flag and I said, hey, you know, let's try it your way.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like the two of you had already gone down the path of filing for a divorce. So how far along in the divorce process were you? And then what was the turning point when you decided to not go through with the divorce?
We were very far along in the divorce. It was a very contentious divorce. We were very angry at one another. I basically rode the roller coaster of his mood. So it was extremely difficult for me to just handle those moods and look underneath there and try to find the husband that I once loved. Now, I kind of had to really remind myself the situation. And so, you know, we were basically saved at the very last moment. I had given up at that point in 2016 on the marriage. Because there was just so much damage done. There was so much verbal abuse. Yeah, it was really, really difficult for me to even care about the marriage at that point. And I wanted him to get better for the sake of the children and for him to be able to be a good father to our three children. So that was kind of my goal for him, to give him that chance and opportunity, because I knew he could be a good father. But in terms of being a good husband and being able to repair our marriage, that came way, way later.
And so was it his willingness to kind of get the help that he needed? Was that kind of what made you realize, Shelly, that like, okay, you're willing to kind of stick this out and see if we can continue to work on the marriage?
Not at the time, no. I mean, I was just focused on him. I was focused on his health and well-being. I wasn't at all focused on the marriage. And so that finally came to a head way later when he moved back to into the house. I mean, he stayed in the basement, bedroom basement. I knew he needed the emotional support. He wasn't going to get it from his family, clearly. And I knew that, you know, medication is only half the equation or even less than that. And that emotional support is key to his well-being. And so if he didn't get that from somebody and it wasn't going to be his parents and it wasn't going to be me, then who was really? I was kind of left holding the bag, and I knew that he deserved a chance to be saved and would be willing to do that with the right mindset. It was just a matter of time for him to come down from that mania. And I knew that. I predicted the roller coaster. It's like you watch this train wreck and you know it's going to occur. Can't do anything about it. Keeps going. But you can predict every little sequence of events before it happens. And you try to warn the person, but they just don't listen.
Right. And so at what point did you call off the divorce?
I think we put the divorce on hold when he moved back into the house right after he had gotten treatment, just because we said, we'll deal with this later. And I don't remember the actual day, though, when we dropped the divorce itself. I don't recall. It took a while, though. It wasn't something that happened overnight. It took a long time to trust.
Yeah. I can imagine. What was the family dynamic like? So talk to us a little bit about your upbringing. I know, Nikhil, you mentioned your father was a psychiatrist. What was like the family background, and what do you think their role was in your mental health journey?
Oh, I mean, it was huge. I mean, when you think about like the ingredients, they always talk about environment being a big contributor to any illness, mental or physical. But yeah, mental illness, I would say, because of the fact that my mother, you know, she was there. Most parents in that age, because, you know, they were coming to this country, they were working very hard to try to make a better living for the family, you know, completely par for the course. So they weren't really around that much. But I would say the unfortunate thing is just that there was too much emphasis on sort of keeping up with the Joneses socially, professionally. And, you know, we always fall into the comparison trap. I mean, I think even people in our generation do it too. But I think that was what was very frustrating for me, was just that in the very brief time that I would spend with my parents, it was always just more about the gap between how I was stacking up versus all my classmates and all the other kids at the temple and stuff like that. So I started placing a lot of emphasis on appearances, and I started placing a lot of emphasis on, there's this unfortunate value system. It's almost like there was a formula for, you know, the number of trophies that were on the fireplace. That was sort of like the barometer of my worth in their eyes. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that this kind of carried throughout, was there was never really consistent support. It was always like, when I was on top, it was always like, you know, we thought you were a diamond in the rough, and we always knew once you sort of cleared out the cobwebs, you'd be off to the races and you'd be doing great. And then when things would crumble, it was always like, one quote was, well, you never had any head for business or stuff like that. So again, and it's like, I don't fault them for this, because it's like, people, they have their limitations, right? And at the end of the day, it's kind of like, these are limitations that they have to work through. I just kind of saw the light and I said, well, let them work on their limitations, and I'm going to work on myself, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's pretty interesting, because your dad being a psychiatrist, his whole world centers around helping people through their mental illnesses and mental journeys. And so I think that's kind of telling, you know, that no matter how educated you are, the cultural stigmas and the cultural expectations can run so deep that it can still clout your reality and clout your judgment.
Yeah. To be honest, I mean, I would say I feel bad for therapists as a whole, not just my dad, but it's just like, it's a very tough job, because you want to have your job, but it's like the last thing you want to do is have that bleed into your home life, you know? So I really applaud therapists who are able to check their emotions or check their clinical hat at the door, but still be there for their kids. Cause I know it's not an easy thing to do.
And right. And like you had said, you know, culture plays a huge role. And I really think it wasn't their fault per se. It was almost partially our fault, because we were incapable of really drawing the line and creating those boundaries. And I think with a collective culture like South Asians, it can be very difficult, because it's embedded culture where you're respectful to your aunts and uncles,
yeah,
in-laws, and you take everybody's opinion, and everybody matters more sometimes than your own opinion. And so that kind of was a wake-up call for us to kind of grow up and start to draw those lines and create respectable, healthy boundaries in the relationships.
Yeah, totally. I mean, in the culture, it's the norm that you are literally marrying into the family. And we all know when things get difficult, it's like 20 times worse when everyone is involved.
Oh, yeah.
The family is involved. Everyone's got a, you know, an opinion. They got to put their own two cents in. And it just becomes so much more complicated to try to maneuver through. One last thing about family. How did this impact your children? And remind us, how many kids do you have?
3 kids.
Okay.
So our daughter's 18 now. Our middle child's 15 and the youngest is 8. It was a very difficult time for them. The youngest didn't remember because he's 8 years old now and he was only 1 at the time. But for the older two, I mean, they started acting out. They had anger. They had resentment. They felt like nobody was really there for them. When I tried to protect them from, you know, their father's mania, I couldn't do it. So I was at the mercy of the court system. So you can imagine these children are literally realizing at such a young age that they're going to have to protect themselves in a way. And so that's when all of the negative behaviors come out, the anger, the manipulation, the lying, like just all these characteristics that have nothing, that are not my children right now to this day, were coming out.
Right.
That was really, really, really difficult to watch because I didn't know where we would end up. And, you know, family plays such a huge role in how your children are raised in their overall well-being in the long run. But, you know, in the long run now, they are such resilient, amazing children. And they have really come full circle and learned such a tremendous amount about the ability to overcome such turmoil in their lives.
Yeah.
Themselves, as well as seeing their mother and their father evolve, you know, through time. And I think they really love the fact that we, even in our 40s, continue to learn and to grow. And there's no end to our personal growth. You know what
right.
I mean? The healing doesn't ever stop. And so I think they love seeing that because we're human beings too. We're not these flawless, you know, gods and individuals to just really look up to, and that's it.
Yeah. So, I mean, if your daughter's 18 now, and this was 2015, 2016, so she would have probably been like, what, 11 or 12 when
she was 12.
The height of all of this. And that's an age where you're old enough to be aware of what's going on. And I'm sure seeing all of that unfold, it's so traumatic on top of all going through adolescence at that age. So that's really amazing to hear that.
Yeah, and I think it's taught her to value the family. I mean, I think because she's in New York for school and she actually comes home once a month. And it's almost like I don't want to say she wants to move back or anything, but it's almost like she feels very comfortable at home. She's more content just to, you know, hang out in sweats and watch Netflix on a Friday night, watch Never Have I Ever or whatever show. You know, it's a far cry. I just remember being that age. I had such a different agenda Friday nights. I mean, I don't know what your relationship with your parents is, but like last person I wanted to see on a Friday night was my parents, even if it was at the temple or any, you know, at some function, the last person I wanted to hang out with was mom and dad. So, I mean, I consider that a win, the fact that our kids actually, you know, don't balk at the idea of being in the same room as us.
Like, totally. I mean, I'm sure that's such a wonderful feeling for you. I mean, when I was 18, I definitely did not want to hang out with my parents on the weekend. Now I do. But definitely not back then. So Nikhil, like, what's your relationship with your daughter now versus before?
I mean, to be honest, I there's no comparison just because there really wasn't a relationship back then. And that's the scary thing, is that I had this notion that because I had so many pictures on Facebook and Instagram of us, you know, going for ice cream, or she was really into this product Lush, like I would take her to go for these pop-up stores in Millennium Park and take pictures. And it was like this really sensationalist thing. And it was like, what's the saying? It's all hat and no cattle. Basically, it was just like, It was a lot of fluff. It was a lot of really cool pictures, and people probably on the outside had this impression, but you know, we really had no relationship because first of all, I was traveling all the time. And so the brief time that I was at home, I was already very short fused. And so it wouldn't really take much for her to set me off, you know? Whereas now, you know, there's still that parent-child relationship. Obviously there's respect, but there's just a lot of camaraderie. There's a very strong bond between us. We have a same kind of sense of humor. We both watch shows like BoJack Horseman, just really kind of have a goofy sense of humor. We exchange memes and TikToks and stuff. So we joke around a lot. And I think I feel very fortunate that, you know, we were able to we were able to build up from a pretty shaky foundation. So I always say to people who are having difficult relationships with their kids, definitely, it's not going to happen overnight, but don't take that latest skirmish or don't take that latest blow up as, don't extrapolate that and assume that that's the way things are going to be, because as I say, time heals all wounds.
And, you know, I'd like to add to that. I always tell parents, especially parents who have young kids, I mean, really rethink how you want to raise your kids and what you want out of the relationship in the long run. Think about your behavior while they're growing up. Controlling. Do you have shackles on their ankles, basically, that everything is no, 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 can't have, because later on, that's going to have huge, tremendous repercussions on their behavior, on their bond with you, on any resentment they potentially have, and also opening the door to their lives, you know, what's really happening in their life when they're 18, 19 years old in college, or are they going to be open toward that? I'm not saying it's a foolproof method, but it really opened up our eyes and ears to how, you know, we wanted to raise our kids and what actually happened as a result. And, you know, the fact that we went through such turmoil, we have tremendous gratitude for what we have today. So we don't take anything for granted.
Yeah. How are you both today? Like, how would you kind of describe the transformation for you as a couple over the last few years?
I'm a completely different person. I mean, I read my manuscript. I read our manuscript and I don't even recognize that person. I can't even relate to her. So it was a full evolution and transformation for me mentally, emotionally, the way I run my company, the way I run my life, our marriage, everything. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like something, this needed to happen to me for my own personal growth. And our marriage is, in my opinion, much, much stronger than it ever was.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's an ongoing process. I would like to just say, like, you know, we just, you know, sprinkled some fairy dust and poof, everything is amazing right now. Things are much better than they were back then. And for me, it's just been a little bit of a struggle just because I still do have that sort of, it's sort of embedded in my DNA, just this outward view of what's going on. And there is still this desire to keep up with the Joneses. I don't think I've completely shed that. But it is something that I'm a lot closer to now than I was before. And, you know, it's interesting in terms of like the pandemic, you know, what effects that has had on sort of my desire to have a full social dance card all the time. Now I'm more like totally fine with just hanging out at home, watching Netflix. And that's fine. I mean, that's a trend that was happening pre-pandemic. But I would say now I'm not as, you know, wedded to that notion of I've got to have a, you know, I've got to be partying every weekend or having 100, my social calendar doesn't need to be as full as it used to be. And then, yeah, professionally, I mean, I think as you're seeing, I mean, things like podcasting, you know, I'm sort of finding my passion in things like that, where it's opening up a lot of connections with the business, with GeoStar, the stem cell therapy company. I'm helping out with marketing on that front. And then also, yeah, the podcast that we have, I just feel like I'm finding more of my creative passion and finding application for things that I think are going to move the needle and make a difference in other people's lives. So, yeah. And I just don't see that would have happened had I been stuck in that management consulting, working for banks and stuff. I mean, I don't see how that would have led to this outcome. So,
right.
You know, that lived experience I am grateful for.
So you got some personal passions that kind of keep you energized and keep you going. Tell us a little bit about
you know, once you got diagnosed, tell us about some of the treatments and care practices that you feel have helped you the most in terms of managing your bipolar disorder and just overall mental health.
Yeah. And I mean, I think for me, the way I got better was I actually had to go into inpatient treatment for a couple of weeks because the severity of it was such that if I had to wait to see a psychiatrist, it could have been weeks and who knows what could have happened at that point. So I actually did have to go in for inpatient therapy and go through ECTs and then just I had to start taking some medication, including like mood stabilizer. And so that was just to get stabilized. But the other part of that was actually finding a good therapist, not just one who's, as I said before, just going to be like a cheerleader and say, oh, you're doing great while, you know, losing losing the next job and going down that road to ruin. So I would say after that period of stabilization, you know, that definitely continues. And I would say to people who are struggling with this, medication is very important. Do not just, because that is the temptation. I don't know about all disorders, but with bipolar, they say they feel better. They want to get off. I would say talk to your doctor, you know, before making any changes. But I would say what's been really, really helpful has just been meditation and mindfulness. And that's something that Shelly and I have really, really embraced. There is one particular platform that we're very passionate about. It's called Mind Valley. And there's a whole host of, if you want to look it up, it's just mindvalley.com. It's just so transformational because there are courses on everything from nutrition to breath work to visualization, just all these types of things you can do to live a better, you know, become a better version of yourself, as cheesy as that might sound. But yeah, I mean, I think it's just that meditation, it's just something that it's something you either love it or you hate it. But for us, it's really it's a must have because there's studies done that the proper breath work exercises can actually have effects that are better than any medication. I'm talking about for like, you know, blood pressure or hypertension, cholesterol, whatever the case is, that these types of exercises can actually have those types of benefits without the side effects. So again, I want to give the caveat and the disclaimer that I'm not a medical professional. Any decisions you make about these types of diseases, definitely consult your doctor. But I would say in addition to those medical interventions and therapy and things like that, I would definitely say meditation has been an absolute must in our lives. It's just the only way to start the day. If you can allocate like 15, 20 minutes, it's something that I think it's required for mental health.
Yeah, that was going to be my clarifying question is what does meditation entail for you? You know, is it first thing in the morning, you set aside 15 minutes and then meditate again before bed? How does your day-to-day look like as far as meditation?
Yeah, usually I'll do about 15 to 20 minutes, you know, after I get the kids ready. It's not like very, very first thing in the morning, but yeah, I'd say like very close to the beginning of my day, it's about 15 minutes. And then usually in the afternoons or like in the early evening, another 15 minutes. Yeah. And it's just, like I said, it's just a great way to just focus on my breath, just sort of quiet the noise in my head, because I think we get so inundated with messages throughout the day, whether it's emails or social media or what have you, that's really the time that I can have that quiet and I can have that sort of internal dialogue with myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's just really incredible to hear the 180 that you guys have been able to do over the last few years and just all that you went through and now coming out on the other side. I think your story is definitely one that can give a lot of hope to other people. And so what advice would you have for family members to support their loved ones who are struggling with a mental health illness?
I would say the biggest thing here is for family members and the people suffering to own their own health. And when I say really own their own health, I mean to, one, surround themselves with professionals, yes, but the right professionals, you know, understand the disease that they have, that, you know, build the enough knowledge and understanding of their condition and what's happening to them or loved ones. So they have the ability to screen the right professionals, to get a team on their side, you know, and to be able to help them through that healing journey and own their health through either holistic modalities, traditional modalities, whatever really resonates with that individual. Mm-hmm. And one of the other biggest things I'd say is to make sure that their loved ones are on this journey with them, because I made that big mistake of not really being on that journey with my husband. And so when you're detached or when you're just not involved and you don't know what else is going on because you have 100 other things on your plates, sometimes those precious moments slip away and later on you might very well regret not being involved.
Own your own health. I love that. So we are almost out of time. Where can people find you and connect with you, plug your podcast, plug your book, and any other resources?
Yeah, before we go there, I just wanted to say again, thanks for having us on. I mean, I'm just super excited. It's just the transformation in mental health in the South Asian diaspora in the last year, because you and I were talking about, you know, our podcasting journeys. You know, it's interesting because a year ago, we didn't have a website, we didn't have the podcast. And now, I mean, you know, to get featured in a publication like Psychology Today, I mean, I just feel so fortunate that we are living in this era, you know, where there is open dialogue about mental health in our culture, because I think it's just been something that's been overlooked for so long. And so I really appreciate you having us on to talk about that. So I'm just wanted to add that. It's a great time to be having this conversation.
Yeah, totally. I feel like we're just starting to scratch the surface as a community to talk openly about all these things that we've traditionally just brushed under the rug.
Yep.
And Nikhil, you want to tell her where they can find us? Or?
Yeah, so there's a couple of places. Just to sort of clarify, we call it the Shelley Story, and it's sort of like a platform. So the Shelley Story, it's the platform that encompasses the book, the movie, the blog, and the podcast. So I'd say the hub for that would be shelleysoo.com. So that's shelleysood.com. I felt like doing an Oscar Mayer commercial there. So that's shelleysoo.com. And then, so that would be the blog. Shelley's done a lot of writing on sites like Medium and then also for the website. And then also theshelleystory.com, that's the podcast. And then we are also on all the social media channels at The Shelley Story. That would be for like Twitter, Instagram.
And you can find our company, Geostar, G-I-O-S-T-A-R, Chicago.com.
Yeah, that's the stem cell therapy and research company that I guess that can be the next episode. Maybe there's a lot to talk about there as well.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Shelley and Nikhil, for coming on our podcast today and sharing your story with our audience.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review. You can also connect with us on Instagram at @thebrowngirl_podcast and all other social media platforms listed in the show notes. Thank you again. I appreciate you being here.